Well, welcome everybody to our live stream, kind of semi-associated with my podcast, Christianity Without Compromise. I got two great guests here today, and I'll let them kind of introduce themselves in a second. But hey, we're chatting about Christian nonviolence and this kind of big question: should Christians kill people? Is lethal force a thing we can have in our arsenal? And the reason I want to have this conversation is because a lot of the things we do on Christian Without Compromise are trying to get back to this is the original church, this is Jesus, and we're trying to kind of move out of the way all this other cluttered stuff that has come 2,000 years of church history and theology, some really charismatic people's opinions, like a lot of stuff gets mixed into this. And so this is an important question on our search to find, what is Jesus all about? What is Jesus' value? What was that early church founded to be like? And one of those questions that Christians were just different on is this question of violence. And I don't know, a month or two ago, we had a special emergency bonus episode roundtable discussion on a Christian response to violence in the world. And we had a lot of great stuff in that, about lamenting and advocating for those that are having violence done against them. But in this episode, I want to get pretty theological, and we'll probably get practical too, but let's lay the foundations here. And I got two great guests, former guests of the Christianity Without Compromise podcast, but that is nowhere near their most notable accolades. So I'll just start with Cody. Cody Cook, who are you, if you can really be summed up in, you know, a couple minutes?
Thought of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer quote, who am I? I do some stuff with the Libertarian Christian Institute, written some books. This was one that they actually published this year, The Anarchist Anabaptist, Essays on Radical Christianity and Freedom. So my specialty kind of more recently has been kind of on the early Anabaptists and kind of trying to, I was going to say translate, but they wrote in German. So that's anyway. So trying to make their work more accessible for contemporary audience. I'm just a guy who loves theology. I'm really interested in kind of where it intersects with politics, kind of Christian anarchism, nonviolence, stuff like that. So that'll probably do for now.
All right, and Jason Porterfield, tell us about yourself in a nutshell.
Sure, yeah. Well, first off, thanks for having me on, Jake, and good seeing you again, Cody. So I grew up in a military family, both parents in the military. But for college, I went to Brethren in Christ College, or at least historically Brethren in Christ, which is one of the historic peace church traditions. A couple weeks into my freshman year, 9/11 happened, and that event just profoundly shaped all 4 years of my college experience, where I began to grapple with my classmates with questions like, what does it mean to follow Jesus in a world that seems to be ever increasingly consumed by war? By the time I graduated, I had wrestled a lot with some Old Testament and New Testament passages and become convinced that Jesus calls us as Christians to forsake the use of violence. But I also, because of that Anabaptist heritage at this college, grew to see God's love for the marginalized and the hurting, his call for justice. And so I joined a missions group after college, who everyone in that missions organization felt called to live and minister among the urban poor, primarily in the slums of Asia. It was started out of New Zealand about 30 years ago. And so, or actually about 40 years ago now. And so I first joined them actually in Canada's poorest neighborhood, and then helped start a team in Jakarta, Indonesia. And in both locations, you know, began to really grapple with how do I actually live out Jesus's peace teaching in the complexity and the messiness of my neighborhood. And eventually it led me to write a book from some of my own reflections and grapplings on that issue. So it's Fight Like Jesus, How Jesus Waged Peace Throughout Holy Week. And that's how we got to know each other, Jake, was through getting to talk about some of the content in that book.
Yeah, we did.
I was going to say, Jason's bio is so much better than my bio. It's kind of embarrassing for me to be here.
No. Jason is very practiced. It's his tone. That's what really sells it. No.
Yeah, Cody, yeah, well, he held up one book, but like I feel like every time he turns over in bed, he's like published another book. So
I know.
He could have held up probably 10 books that he's written.
So true. So, yeah. So true. Yeah, well, again, thanks for both of you guys for being on here. We've gotten to know each other in different spaces. One of those is a guest on the podcast. Jason and I have had kind of been connected for years, it was that book that we got connected with. I'm pretty sure it was an Instagram ad, actually, for your lead magnet about, well, could get into this, all the 100 quotes about Christians not thinking killing was a great idea. We'll get into that church history for sure. So thanks for sharing that so much. Now, I want to get into kind of our stories a little bit. Jason, you talked about this. Cody, you'll go next here to talk about your relationship with violence and kind of your path here. Maybe you were born a libertarian, nonviolent guy. Maybe. I don't know. But we'll go into that in a second here because I don't know your story super well. But a little bit about me. My journey is interesting because I was raised in the Church of Christ, a part of the Restoration Movement, which nowadays is not what you would call in kind of that peace church tradition. But if you go back in time a little bit, and this is what I was learning in college, when you learn about your own denominations, your own, I have to stop myself there because the Church of Christ people get mad that I said denomination, your own tradition, sect, whatever you want to call it, start to realize, oh my goodness, it wasn't that long ago when they were all conscientious objectors. And they, some of them were, you know, you had your David Lipscombs who were very not for government involvement and different things like that. And so that's when I started to wrestle with this. And of course, being a Bible major in college, getting to know Jesus and studying this thing and realizing, hold on a second, these things I'm reading here don't seem to jive with kind of the efficient or quote unquote efficient methods, the kind of methods that we try to do and conquer with and get things done in the world today. So that was my journey. It didn't make everybody happy because when I say, oh yeah, I'm a pacifist, people think, okay, so you just want to get punched, you know, and you're just, you know, you let somebody kidnap your wife and kids or something like that. And we can maybe go into some of those misconceptions later, but that's briefly my journey. I felt like it was kind of coming to terms with that religious tradition of mine, even though we had left that and seeing that as a part of kind of where I came from and, hey, where I want to go to get back to that spirit of being more like the early church. So, Cody, if you will, can you fill in some gaps here on your journey?
So how do I do this in a short way? So my mom's side of the family is was fairly nominally Christian. There's some Methodist circuit riders back there somewhere. And my dad's side of the family was kind of more traditional Southern Baptist. And so that was kind of the where I was baptized and my church experience. And so, you know, naturally, I was an atheist before I hit double digits. No, not naturally, but that was my experience. And I think my teen years, I spent as, you know, kind of an atheist who was really interested in, you know, movements that were kind of dissenting kind of movements. I got really fascinated with like sort of the 1960s radicals and, you know, I grew my hair long and I smoked pot for political reasons. It was, I mean, it didn't make any sense in the time that I did it. But I think it was, you know, I'm just a few years younger than Jason. So when I was in high school, that was 9/11, that was the Iraq War. And so I was, you know, kind of already inclined to be really, I think, suspicious of a lot of that stuff because of where I was moving. And so I really sort of, you know, resonated a lot with kind of like the Yippies and the Black Panthers and some of those people who were, you know, rallying against the Vietnam War when Iraq was going on. And so it was kind of, there's different things that brought me back to Christianity, which would take a while to get into, I think. But I think because I had an experience of Christianity that made me kind of pulled me away. And then I started looking at it again and thinking, okay, well, this isn't exactly what I was told. And I also sort of had that sort of dissenting, you know, kind of spirit. I was somebody who said, okay, well, I'm going to figure this out and I'm not going to take anybody's word for it. And there's that line from Chesterton about how once he put the finishing touches on his heresy, he realized it was orthodoxy. And so I became this sort of orthodox Christian who is really rooted in, you know, the New Testament and the early church. through this process of kind of discovery of not wanting to let anybody tell me what the faith taught. And in that process, you know, I studied the church fathers, I studied church history, and I came across these people, the Anabaptists, that I thought were just really fascinating. And they practiced nonviolence. And, you know, when you become, you know, an evangelical Protestant or whatever, you hear there's a lot of kind of anti-Catholic stuff, and you'll pick up like Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is this whole, all these stories about how those horrible Catholics mistreated the Protestants. And you think, well, man, we had it figured out. They didn't. They were oppressing the righteous and all that. And then you find, oh, the Catholics have their books too about Protestants killing them. But the only people who didn't seem to be killing people were the Anabaptists, with the exception of a few, you know, weird radicals in Munster. So, I think I was really intrigued by the Anabaptists, but I was not, you know, I was interested in, you know, the anti-war stuff, and some of that crossed over into pacifism, but I wasn't totally sure about that. I also had kind of this kind of Black Panthers sort of self-defense, you know, streak as well. I think over time, just reading the scripture and trying to be faithful to it, and, you know, learning from the church fathers and some of the Anabaptists, I came to nonviolence as, you know, basically what scripture was teaching. That's a little bit long, but that's basically how I got here.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. And both of your stories a little bit are in, those former episodes that I mentioned that you were on the show. I'm sure you've talked about some of that in other places. So, you know, it's the natural next step. People, you know, fall in love with you guys. They want to know more. We'll link those in the show notes and all that fun stuff. But, you know, promotion aside, let's talk about why we're really here. And that's Jesus. So when you're engaging with Jesus in the Gospels, what are the kinds of material that Jesus is teaching on? What are the kind of things you're seeing pop up there that inform this approach to violence, to not killing, to self-defense, to anything like that? We can't maybe cover the breadth of everything here, but let's maybe go deep on a couple little parts here. So either one of you want to just kind of start with something that jumps out, something you want to bring up?
I'll let Jason cover that first. I think I've been talking for a little bit. Let's hear him for a minute.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. When I think of what Jesus's posture towards violence, I think of both his teaching and his actions. And so when it comes to his teaching, you know, there's a blessed are the meek, not the powerful, for the meek will inherit the earth. Blessed are the peacemakers, not the warmongers, right? The peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. In fact, the only ones in the Gospels described as children of God are the peacemakers and those who love their enemies. Interesting, right? It's almost as if Jesus is saying, when you love your enemies and wage peace, you're like the spit and image of your Father in heaven. You're the spirit and image of God. Nothing looks more like your Father in heaven than when you love enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who persecute you. Do not violently resist an evil person. Turn the other cheek. Go a second mile. Put your sword away, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight. And on and on and on Jesus goes. But there's also the actions in his life. And as you both know, that's why I ended up writing Fight Like Jesus, because I could quote Jesus's peace teaching verbatim when I lived in Canada's poorest neighborhood. But I was struggling to figure out how to actually cultivate peace in that location. And that's when I realized, you know, about a third of the Gospels focus on Jesus's last week, what we call Holy Week. And while that content certainly contains some teaching from Jesus, it's also action-packed. We get to see Jesus apply his own peace teaching. You know, whether it's Jesus choosing to ride a donkey, a symbol of peace, instead of a war horse, as he made his not-so-triumphal entry on the day we now call Palm Sunday, or Thursday of Holy Week in the upper room, you know, he takes the bread and he breaks it. And instead of saying, this is my enemy's body, break it for me, he says, this is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. And then he models his commitment to nonviolence by allowing Judas to leave unharmed, despite the fact that it was 12 men at least against one in that upper room. On the cross, right? His very first words on the cross after he's been nailed to it, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive those who are executing me. I'm going to pause there in case Cody wants to add anything, but there are a few passages that tend to get lobbed at pacifists or those who believe in nonviolence as being pro-violence from Jesus. And I'm happy to talk about those too, but I'm curious what your thoughts are, Cody.
Yeah, no, and I was going to say, I like that you kind of went with some of the practical stuff, because I think what happens sometimes, what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount that sounds very practical, people tend to over-spiritualize it, and they say, well, you know, he doesn't really mean to do this literally. And so where I went was 1 Peter, because 1 Peter says we're to imitate Christ, right? And so he's writing to these people, these are Christians who are oppressed by the state, by pagan slave masters who are ruling over them with force. And he says, you know, what credit is there if when you sin and you're harshly treated, you endure it with patience, but when you do what is right and you suffer, that finds favor with God. And he says, for you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. And so what does he say that Jesus did? What are we following in his steps? What are we walking after him in? Well, he committed no sin. There wasn't deceit found in his mouth. He didn't revile in return when he was suffering. He didn't utter threats. He kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he bore our sins in his body on the cross. And so because of that, don't return evil for evil or insult for insult. Give a blessing instead. I think Peter gives, I think, very practical examples here. And he says, not just to follow Jesus as an example, not just to imitate Christ, when he was nice to tax collectors and prostitutes, which is great, but when he's beaten and crucified to death by his enemies. And so he's our example. We follow in his steps. And when we do so, Peter says, well, this will often actually be practical in turning away violence and aggression from us, but not always. And when it doesn't, even when it doesn't, we're to bless those who do evil to us so that we might also inherit a blessing. And so the way that I think people who are looking at Jesus and listening to the Sermon on the Mount, like Peter, are applying this stuff is very practical. And it involves loving our enemies by not killing them, by not doing violence to them, by actually doing good for them. And so there are people, you know, like Augustine, who are going to over-spiritualize that and say, well, you can love somebody while you put a spear through their brain. I don't see that in the New Testament, and I don't see that for at least a couple hundred years in the early church.
Jake, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, you guys hit a lot of the main ones there. For me, it's been the Sermon on the Mount as just kind of the encapsulation of here's the code for the new kingdom here. Here's what to do. And goodness gracious, it's really difficult to live out those kind of principles that are in the Sermon on the Mount, in this good summary of kingdom ethics here. But you cannot escape the fact that, like, this new kingdom just doesn't seem to have a place for the means and methods of the world. You mentioned the blessed are the peacemakers. Hard to spin that, although I'm sure people have tried. And the love your enemies thing, that also has been something that I think really shifted me, where I think sometimes we've just cheapened love, like, we'll just kind of like be kind to them or something like that. But the Jesus love is so much more. It's about caring for somebody's, I think, material well-being, and that means not killing them. It means that kind of love, and that's really crazy. And we love the love your neighbor part. Even, you know, many of the, I'll just use the term progressive Christians today, we love that love your neighbor stuff. But then it's like, but don't forget, there's also the love your enemy part. It's like, okay, well, now nobody is excluded anymore. Your neighbor or your enemy, nobody's excluded. All of us, we must have this love that cares for their well-being, their physical body, whether that's giving them food or, you know, not putting a spear through their head would be a great example of loving somebody. So great stuff.
It's a great place to start, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. Yeah. Here's what not to do.
Minimum.
It's fair. I mean, I will say one of the Ten Commandments that's easiest for me to follow is the not murdering people. Other people have more of a challenge with that one, but hey, I not to brag, I've been pretty good at that one. Others of them, well, we won't get into them, but that one, you know, seem to be okay at. So, I mean, I don't want to move on from Jesus. Jesus is really central and important, but I do know you guys both love your church history and you love to kind of talk about what this early church was up to outside of this particular collection we call the New Testament, this early witness. So if you want to talk about some of the themes that you see sort of in the early church, I mentioned Jason had all those quotes earlier. He always has a good quote in his pocket. But Cody, I know you're also passionate about, don't just stop at St. Augustine. You got to go back even further to see what that church was up to.
I'll definitely let Jason go first because he does have that resource, which I think he ought to mention and promote and tell people how to get a hold of. But then once he's laid the groundwork, I might throw in a couple of things that maybe he won't mention and we'll just go from there.
Sure. And you read a couple quotes again on that episode that you were on, but yeah, what do you want to highlight from that or just from general themes that you see?
Sure. Yeah. So, man, where to begin?
Exactly. You
know, years and years ago, probably like 2007, I think it was, I was asked to speak at my home church, come back from Canada and speak. And I said, yes. Southern Baptist, very conservative church surrounded by Army base, Navy base. And then a couple of weeks before that sermon, one of my missionary colleagues came bursting in my room and he's like, guess what day they asked you to preach on? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, they asked you to preach on Veterans Day. And I just thought, oh no, the church is lone pacifist and they had to ask me, you know? Now in my 40s, I probably would have contacted the pastors and been like, hey, there was probably a mistake. But back then I felt like God was saying, you can't back out of this. I set this up, you know? Long story short, you know, I did preach on Veterans Day and I talked about God's heart for loving enemies, et cetera. And I did lose some financial support, some substantial financial support. And I was worried I was going to have to leave and return home. But soon after we were in Philadelphia. So my home church was somewhere else in Pennsylvania. We were about to fly back to Canada from Philly. But we had a few hours. So we thought, well, let's catch up with a friend of ours, Shane Claiborne. And my missionary colleague was all excited to tell him the story of that Veterans Day sermon. And I'll never forget, Shane said to me, he said, you know, the interesting thing about November 11th is even though churches have paused now for 70, 80 years on that day to honor those Christians who have bravely fought on behalf of their country, the church has actually paused for centuries on that very same day to honor and remember the life of a Christian who refused to fight, even though his country demanded it. His name was Saint Martin of Tours, and his saint's day is November 11th. And so that got me wanting to learn about church history. It was that conversation that sparked my curiosity. And I began to read a whole bunch of thick kind of academic books, trying to find every quote from the early church I could find, and ultimately put together that resource that you mentioned. It started out as 100 early Christian quotes on not killing. And a few months back, I upped it to 140 early Christian quotes on not killing. So it's available on my website, or I can give you the link for your podcast when that episode comes out, jasonporterfield.com, and you can get it right there. It's just a free PDF that you can download. One page introduction, and then 140 quotes, because I just want the early church to speak for themselves on this issue. So maybe I'll mention a few quotes. I don't have them all memorized, so I got them written down here. But the two that I think summarize best the early Christian stance are Clement of Alexandria, writing in the second century. He said this, above all, Christians are not allowed to correct by violence sinful wrongdoings. And then Lactantius, in the turn of the third to fourth century, he said, no exception at all ought to be made to the rule that it is always wrong to kill a man or a woman whom God willed to be a sacred creature. No exception, right? These words, they reveal the early church's stance on this issue of violence. Under no circumstance, be it war, vengeance, or even self-defense, were Christians permitted to harm another person. And in fact, this conviction is so central that when you look at all the extant writings that we've uncovered and found, in other words, the writings that we've actually found from the early church, there's not a single Christian writing in which the writer approves of Christians using violence. There are a couple that mention rumors or hearing of Christians perhaps trying to join the military. Sometimes we think they became a Christian while they're already in the military. So the question was what to do with it. But even in those contexts, This is pre-Constantine. Even in those contexts, the writers themselves disapprove of the Christians using violence. So I could share a lot more, many more quotes, but let me turn it over to Cody if he wants to add anything.
Yeah, I'll add a few things to that. I think one thing that's worth noting, just because I think it's interesting, is that when that transition begins to happen, and Augustine's definitely a major thinker there, there's still a sense that they don't want to get rid of the Sermon on the Mount. And so, like, what Augustine kind of does is he's really wary of even self-defense. Like, I think our rationale as kind of individualist Westerners is, well, self-defense obviously is a place you have to, you know, you have to do that, right? But Augustine sort of says, well, you can kill when you're doing it for Caesar, but as an individual, as a non-citizen, you're a Christian, so you still have to follow the Sermon on the Mount. Luther and Calvin even at times sort of lean in that direction, which is kind of fascinating to me. But I'll mention just, I think, two things in addition to that. One is that when you go back and you look at the early church, one passage that gets referenced a lot is Isaiah 2 about beating swords into plowshares. And there's a longer article I wrote about this for Plow called How Do You Know a Christian? And what's really interesting about the way that they use this passage is they see it as fulfillment, right? So we would look at Isaiah 2, swords into plowshares. Yeah, someday we'll get there, right? And what the early church said is, well, this has already been fulfilled because Jesus came and the people who follow Jesus don't go to war. Therefore, Jesus is the Messiah. And sort of implicit in that, I think, would be a critique that if you are taking up the sword, that you are in some sense disowning Jesus or disclaiming his messiahship, which I think is really kind of a fascinating way to think about it. One more thing I'll mention is Tertullian gets brought up a lot because he's got a lot on this, but one thing he says that's really kind of fascinating to me, he talks about the sacrament of Caesar. And he's, I think, the first church father, first example we have of the word sacrament being used in a Christian context. Because a sacramentum was a pledge, an oath that a soldier made of allegiance to Caesar. And Tertullian takes that and goes, well, you can't have a sacramentum, a sacrament to Caesar, and a sacrament to Christ. There's a contradiction there. You have to pick one. So I think of that, you know, when I think about baptism, which we call a sacrament today, and the way that the old spiritual talks about it, that, you know, I'm going to lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, and I ain't going to study war no more. And so, you know, there's, I think, when we are being baptized into Christ, we are baptized into his death, we are raised up to new life with him, we are following after him, as Peter says, and part of that means that we are committed to him and not to Caesar, and we set our sword aside.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of mythos around Constantine, but I've heard this story before about, like, how he got all his soldiers baptized, but, you know, they kept their sword-bearing arm out of the water or something so that wouldn't be baptized. I don't know if that really happened. Like I said, there's a lot of weird mythology around that guy.
There is. And actually, I heard another story kind of like that about Constantine recently. One thing that I think is sort of documented historically is that he waited to be baptized on his deathbed. But I heard someone say recently that the rationale for that was, and I haven't been able to look into this, that he had been told that a Christian was not supposed to kill. And as a commander of armies, the reason he waited till his deathbed to be baptized is he was not willing to give up the sword. And so once he knew he wasn't going to be able to pick it up anymore, that was when he chose to be baptized. I don't know if that's true, but maybe Jason's heard of that. I don't know. I thought that was fascinating.
I've heard that as well. There's also the story of his mother-in-law gifting him what were thought to be the nails used to crucify Jesus. At least that's what he thought they were. And he had them melted down and turned into bits for his war horse to go into battle. Oh. So just some irony there. Yeah.
And then to talk about, you know, swords into plowshare, like Shane Claiborne is an example of somebody who literally is melting down guns and turning them into garden tools today. So
yeah,
much better than any bits for your war horse.
One of my favorite early church quotes is from Cyprian, who wrote in Latin, spoke Latin. So he's kind of an accidental English poet or rhymer when he said, God made iron for tilling, not killing. So.
Yep. So, I mean, we're not solving all the problems. We're scratching the surface for a lot of things here. But I do want to talk about some of the arguments against this. And one of the first one is just kind of a historical question of, okay, but that was then. I know, you know, I've heard Cody in some debates, and I know his opponent, at least in one particular debate I'm thinking of, brought up a point of, well, you know, the Christians weren't in power at that time, so just like effectively they couldn't really kill and they couldn't really do this kind of thing. But once they got in power, maybe a different formula. Or we've already talked a little bit about the spiritualification of like the Sermon on the Mount. Like, hey, Jesus, nice idea, cool stuff, but like we live in the real world, bro. Like that's not going to happen. So what do you kind of say to this question of, that's nice and all, but like not realistic. Maybe that was good for a time, but does that really apply in, to date the podcast, 2025?
Yeah, well, and what I thought of when you made that argument about, referenced it, that argument about how, you know, well, that was when they didn't have political power. So they were, you know, of course they were speaking about nonviolence then. It's sort of like saying, well, of course I was saying that adultery is a sin. That was when no one was interested. Now that someone's interested, I'd feel differently about it. I think you're going to get those kinds of, I think, you know, just moral justifications. And Jason actually can probably speak to some of these, but you hear rationales like, well, turn the other cheek. That's a slap on the cheek is an insult. It's not like lethal force, right? So yeah, of course, turn the other cheek if you're insulted. Or, well, that's a personal enemy. It's not a national enemy, despite the fact that Jesus is talking about Romans beating, you know, Jewish people who have been subjugated. And so, you know, I think, you know, that, so that's one you're going to get. You're going to talk, people talk about Romans 13, right? But that the magistrate is a tool of God's vengeance, but they'll always leave out Romans 12, where that same word is used in, I think, another form, avenger. And I think it's the verbal form in 13 and the nominal form in 12, that Christians do not seek vengeance, but we leave it to the Lord, right? And there's also a lot of other things happening in Romans 13 that is a little off topic, but for folks who are interested, there's an episode of the Libertarian Christian podcast called Problem Passages for Libertarian Christians, Romans 13, where I talk more about that. I think there's the violence in the Old Testament question. That comes up a lot. Well, there's violence in the Old Testament. You have God going to war. But Jason quoted John 18:36 earlier. Yes, physical nations do violence. But where does Jesus's kingdom come from? Is it of this world, or is it a spiritual kingdom? And if it's a spiritual kingdom, do we fight? Jesus says no. And so, you know, people also debate, you know, exactly how to interpret some of those Old Testament passages, but I'm fine to read them on the surface and just say, okay, but yeah, Jesus says this is different. This is not the same thing. Buy a sword comes up, Luke 22:36, where Jesus tells them to buy a sword. People always quote that out of context, and they miss, I think, the very next verse, because why does Jesus say to buy a sword? He says, because what was written about me needs to be fulfilled. And what was it that was written about him? He was numbered with the transgressors. Those who bear swords are transgressors. They're sinners. They're bad people. And so Jesus has to buy a sword for that reason. And then, of course, what happens when Peter misunderstands and uses the sword? And you know, shortly that later on that evening, Jesus says, enough of this. Put your sword in its place, because he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. And Tertullian wrote that Jesus disarmed all Christians when he disarmed Peter. I think probably one of the more, I think, weighty objections, and I'd be interested in hearing what Jason has to say about this, is this objection about, well, you have a personal responsibility for your country or your family. And that last one, I think, especially, you know, feels kind of weighty. And, you know, there's biblical precedent, of course, for the idea that we're responsible for those under our care. So Paul shames men who don't provide for their families. He doesn't specifically talk about, you know, using force to protect them or whatever, but it seems reasonable to think that kind of makes sense, that you know, the security of your family is something you should care about and want to secure. And so, you know, if that's the case, that we have this special responsibility for those under our care, doesn't that mean we should be prepared to kill our enemies if that means increasing the likelihood that our loved ones will be safe? And I say that very deliberately, because I think there's this myth that violence always works, and that if only you have a gun, everything's going to come out all right. If only, you know, and that's obviously not the case, but sometimes violence works in the sense of you get what you want out of it, right? And so, you know, there might be some circumstances where if you had a gun in your house, you know, in this rare instance, that you maybe save a life. Maybe not, obviously, maybe not the person who breaks in, but but maybe someone you care about, your family that's under your charge. So I think that one has some weight for me. It also has, of course, emotional weight as a father, someone who cares about my kids and my wife, and, you know, I want to take care of them. So I don't, I'd be interested in hearing what you guys might think about that particular objection. Not that I'm the host, but I'm curious to hear. It's not like yet. I've tried to.
Jason, yeah, whatever you want to add here to kind of these arguments against, if you will, nonviolence.
Sure, yeah. Cody, I might save that last one for, I think we're going to talk a little bit about some of those like what if scenarios.
Yeah, let's do that. That sounds good.
And that's the classic one. What if someone comes to hurt your family, right? Those you love. So I'll give some more thoughts on that. But you talked about, you know, some of those objections or those theological and moral justifications that Christians use to justify using violence today. And you mentioned how some people say, well, that's on your, on a personal level, you as an individual are to love your enemies, but there's a whole national political level too, you know. But it is interesting that, you know, Jesus, not only does he say, my kingdom is not of this world, if it were, my servants would fight, but in what's called the little apocalypse recorded in Mark, and I think Matthew, he says, you know, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. But you, in other words, you're not going to be part of the nations and the kingdoms that are warring. You're a completely separate group. And what's he say about that? You will be brought before judges in the courts. That would have been the Roman context. And you'll be persecuted in the synagogues. In other words, you're going to be hated by both sides. The Romans and your fellow countrymen are going to hate you because of your refusal to fight. And in Fight Like Jesus, I unpack that little apocalypse passage. And it's a substantial depth, and look at how the early church understood that passage. And actually, when the abomination that causes desolation, this recycling of the apocalyptic language in Daniel's book of Daniel, they understood that to mean when the temple is once again defiled with blood. And there are a few incidents that could describe it. Jesus says, you know, flee to the hills. Don't participate in the fighting. And we actually know that's what the Christians did in Jerusalem right before the final siege of Jerusalem, where then Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD. There was a slaughtering of two Jewish factions. The Jewish-Roman War of 67 to 70 AD was just as much a civil war among these rival Jewish factions. And so one group snuck in and killed the other Jewish group in the temple. And the Christians fled, we know, to the foothills of Judea, to a town called Perea, and didn't participate in the fighting. I think also, you know, when people say, oh, Jesus, when he said love your enemies, he wasn't talking about your nation's enemies. But then I think about the passage that's actually often used to justify violence, the faith of that centurion who Jesus said his faith was so great, right? I belong to a Quaker church now, there's a few different kind of friends denominations, I guess they might call themselves. And the one that I happened to be a part of a few years back were trying to push through a change to basically rescind the church's peace stance. And when I voiced concern about that, the person leading the charge said, but Jesus said a soldier's faith was the greatest, right? And so I had to say, well, number one, Jesus commended his faith, not his occupation. But number two, you cannot understand the importance of that passage unless you can answer the question, to whom did Jesus make that comment about the centurion's faith? It was not to the centurion. The text explicitly states that Jesus turns to the crowd of his fellow countrymen and says to them, assuredly, I say to you, I haven't seen such faith like this, not even in all of Israel. It's like, oh, snap, you know, like that's going to hurt. In other words, even our nation's enemies, even the leader of a enemy adversarial army could have such faith. So how can we go and kill them, right? One of the common justifications I hear, it's been touched on, Augustine talked about it, Luther, you brought up Cody, his teaching is called the two kingdoms theology, I've often heard it referred to, or this dual ethic, right? This as an individual Christian, we love our enemies. We don't use violence, but we have a duty to our nation, right? And so, you know, it's interesting to me, like the early church, Tertullian, he said, military service does not hold out escape from punishment of sins. Nowhere does the Christian change his character. But Luther said the exact opposite. These two kingdoms live by two different ethics, and our responsibility to each demands different responses. Origen, you know, you mentioned the claim, Cody, how a lot of people will say, well, yeah, when the early church was a small minority and persecuted, of course, they were for nonviolence. But once they became powerful and big in number, then, of course, it was okay for them to join the military. But that is a distortion of the historical record. You know, Origen said, you cannot demand military service of Christians any more than you can of priests, which, by the way, right, nowadays we often will say, well, priests can't serve in the military, but regular Christians can, right? And then he goes on and says, we do not go forth as soldiers with the emperor, even though he demands it. In other words, there were times when the emperor and the Roman leadership, military leadership, said, you have to fight for us. And they still said no, right? Some of the other justifications I hear are kind of the ends justify the means, or I would say these fictional, imagined, concocted, feared ends we use to justify violent means. Also, like you said, the appeal to the Old Testament and, you know, the early Christian writings, they're often referring to Jesus, 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 or some of the Hebrew prophets that speak about converting instruments of killing into instruments that cultivate life, these garden tools, right? But you see that shift in the church writings from Augustine onwards, where they start to quote from King David, for example, right? And I would just say this, someone should do a PhD thesis in this, but I think you ought to look at how Jesus used the Hebrew scriptures, because I have found that the consistency and the precision with which he sometimes removes the violent sections of a passage and fuses what's left together, it can only be explained as intentional. And so, you know, if Jesus used the Hebrew scriptures in that way, then I think we ought to be careful when we use them to justify a stance that goes against the way of Jesus. And then finally, I would just say, you know, I think one's eschatology is often used to justify violence. One's view of the end times, this especially dispensationalism or, premillennial dispensationalism. Often the book of Revelation is used. You know, there's that famous Mark Driscoll statement where he talks about, you know, in Revelation, Jesus has a tattoo on his leg and a sword in his hand, and he's slaying his enemies. And he goes on to say, I couldn't worship a hippie Jesus because I could beat him up, right? Man, I'll give my 1 minute overview of the book of Revelation. But, you know, the sword is not in his hand, it's in his mouth. It's a metaphor, right? Sorry, yeah. The word of God, a double edged sword. Yes, there's blood on his robe, but it's on his robe before he even goes into battle. It's his own blood, hint, hint, right? It says in Revelation 6 that we all look up expecting to see the Lion of Judah. And what do we see instead? The tender, meek little lamb, right? In the end, it's the lamb that sits upon the throne, not these beasts of empire and these seven-headed dragons of sin. And in the end, the witnesses who remain faithful are those who remain faithful to the teachings of Jesus and are willing to be killed, lay down their own life, not to kill others in the book of Revelation. That's a quick run through. Romans 13, you got to cover that, right? Overcome evil with good, Romans 12, but Romans 13, submit to the governing authorities and they have the sword. And that is often used, right? To say, well, we have to submit to the governing authorities. And the word submit there, it's not the word obey in Greek. Submit is like the early Christians who refused to offer sacrifices to Caesar's gods, yet prayed for him as he fed them to his lions. That's submissive disobedience. But the key part in Romans 13 that people just seem to overlook is Paul explicitly states, he says, look, pay the tax to who taxes are due and the custom to who customs are due. But ultimately, here's the litmus test. You owe no one anything but love. That's verse 8. And then he goes on to clarify, just in case love is too vague of a concept. And love does no harm to another, verse 10. So when the Caesars of this world say that we owe it to them to fight in their militaries, to kill their nation's enemies, Paul says, you owe them nothing but love, a love that does no harm to another.
Well, and I'll add one thing. I know that there's one passage you don't have a response to, Jason, and that is Jesus used violence in the temple. Therefore, and I'm sure you guys covered that in your previous episode. So I'll throw that out as a reference that people should go back and listen to the previous interview with Jake and Jason on that topic.
And just buy his book too. Skip right to the source.
Yeah, forget that. Just buy the book.
Oh, yeah, but my podcast is good too.
Yeah, we'll do both. Do both.
But you're exactly right. That passage, the temple cleansing, is used to justify horrendous acts of violence throughout church history. But like I argue in the book and talk probably on the podcast before with Jake, yeah, it doesn't describe Jesus whipping people. Rather, it shows that he's not passive. He doesn't sit idly by and do nothing in the midst of injustice.
Well, and even if he had whipped somebody with it, that you don't get from there to carpet bombing Iraqi civilians. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, thanks for kind of covering a lot of those things. Once again, I always have to do the disclaimer of this episode is not meant to be the final word on everything. Like, you might have a question that somebody didn't answer here. It's probably been answered in one of their writings and somebody else. Like, you know, this is not a new discussion of let's think about Christian relationship to violence. Like, we've been having this for 2,000 years. Like we said, some of those OG Christians, they were wrestling and thinking with this and having some pretty strong opinions and trying to tell other people about that. So thanks for that, both of you, for that kind of tour of all the different but kind of questions. Really, for me, I'm on this kick all about kind of this American obsession with efficiency and optimization and things like that, that in itself as an idol, and violence comes up so often because to a lot of people, it does seem like the easiest, simplest option. Somebody runs at me with a weapon, I got to kill them. Like, you know, that is the quote unquote simplest solution here to this. Or if such and such nation is being a little mean, we got to go carpet bomb them for some reason. In some people's mind, that makes sense logically as a easy solution. I know as a teacher, I draw a lot of my best stories from my time in the classroom. And there were kids that were doing things that were making me lose my mind. And it would be easy. I didn't actually think of like punting them across the room, to be clear, but it would be easy sometimes to be like, I just want to beat this kid up. I want to throw them out the window, throw them out of my classroom or something. But the way of Jesus is often more imaginative. It's a little longer. It takes time. It relies on relationships. It's not that easy, quick A to B efficient option. So that's one of the responses I see to a lot of this. Our mindset is wrong. When we think of violence, we think of, well, it has to be this way. And it absolutely does not have to be. We are really lacking in imagination, I think, in our modern world as Christians, as just people in general. So,
well, I agree with that. I think I'm thinking a little about your kind of efficiency argument there, because I think, you know, I I'm a free market guy. I kind of like efficiency, but it's also like, because I think, you know, you don't want to expend, more time or effort than you need to on something. But that also sort of like, if you marry that to a kind of a pragmatism where there are no values, that there's nothing that you need to avoid. Cause like, you know, there's this old sketch on the Mitchell and Webb radio show where it's like, you know, it's like an advertisement for a bleach company. And they're like, we make bleach the old fashioned way. I think it's okay to say like, don't waste time or energy or money when you don't have to. But like, ultimately, this is, I think, a question of what does Jesus want us to do? And if Jesus wants us to avoid something that's bad, well, then you don't take the shortcut to the bad thing. You take the long way around to the good thing. And I'm not saying to undermine anything you said, but I'm just to kind of add another thought to that.
Agree. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm not against, you know, I guess when I buy my food from the grocery store, I don't go and farm it myself. Sorry. You know, it's like, I do sometimes take the easier option, but you have to be careful of when I take that option, what am I missing out on? Who am I stepping over or stepping on to get there? You have to have those kind of thought processes. So that's my little soapbox there.
Yeah, fair
enough. Jason, do you have any quick points there, or I want to move to some of those what ifs?
No, what ifs. That's great.
Okay. Well, let's say we got about 10 minutes left. Let's shoot for about 10 minutes more here. So again, can't cover everything, but there are these prevalent what if scenarios that come to people's minds for good reason, because maybe somebody's been saying, I get it, Jesus, early church, I get what you're saying, I love it. Ideally, it sounds great, but then we always come with the, but what if in this scenario that seems like I there is another option here? So let's do the self-defense one. What do you say when somebody says, well, somebody is threatening me with or my family? Well, let's do the family one. They're threatening all of us, you know, with a weapon, with a gun. And, you know, what's my option here? Is it okay for me to go and kill them or something? Or, you know, if we think of it like a lot of the big Marvel movies, even like, yeah, we have the good guy. He's technically has his no killing code, but still in the end, it's sometimes a little easier for the bad guy to fall off, you know, a cliff or something like that. It's just, you know, it's always kind of easier if we just stop them for good. And even some modern, even in the superhero genre, is questioning, well, what if you keep letting that guy live? I don't know. I mean, I'm going off into some crazy scenarios here, but let's just address that self-defense thing, that idea of, is it okay if I just kill him and stop him for good to protect somebody I love and I should be responsible for?
Yeah, there's a clear, concise, compelling answer that I'm sure Cody's about to give you. So, no.
This is your field, man. Yeah.
I think so. There's a few assumptions that are usually behind those kind of hypothetical what if kind of questions. I think one of them is that you have to choose between taking care of people that you're responsible for and enemy love, that you can't do both. And, you know, I think we're still called to love our enemies. Right. And I think, you know, I think some people differ, but I think you can reconcile some kinds of force with enemy love. I don't think it's unloving to restrain or incapacitate a dangerous person to stop them from hurting others. But I do have a really hard time saying it, that it's loving to kill them. I think that that should be a place where I think we can kind of get that from scripture. And that sounds very reasonable. And I think I would also say, like, let's say this is the thing that's stopping somebody from coming to nonviolence. This, well, maybe, you know, 0.1% of the time, lethal force is the only way to save an innocent person or something. Okay, let's say that's acceptable in that very rare circumstance. But the text of scripture and the spirit of Jesus tell us that suffering enemy love should always be given the benefit of the doubt, that it should be pursued in almost every other circumstance, at least, right? So let's do that. So if there's these few rare little circumstances where you're not sure about, okay, we'll set those aside, pray about that, work through that, but join us on this is how we should be living. The enemy love thing is really should be how we should be living. Another assumption is that violence is the most effective way to deal with conflict. So people are going to assume basically that, well, if you keep a gun in your home, you're more likely to be able to protect yourself and your family than you are to hurt someone that you care about, despite the fact that statistically the opposite is true. Or you're mugged in the street. Well, if you have a gun, the situation is going to naturally resolve itself, and it's not going to be, you know, escalating into your death. Or, you know, some will say, well, you can't defeat a tyrant, a Hitler, with peaceful methods, even though studies have been done by folks like Erica Chenoweth that demonstrate that nonviolent revolutions are actually more effective than violent ones. And so not to be cliched.
Nearly twice as effective.
Right. Yeah. Significantly. Yeah. And so not to be cliched, but, you know, maybe we should be more inclined to, you know, give peace a chance. I think the third assumption that's being made is that Jesus hasn't given us any guidance on this question. So we have to just be pragmatic or efficient. And so, but if you're a Christian, you should want to obey Jesus no matter what. And I think that's true, even if violence sometimes might accomplish a goal better than nonviolence might, right? We're in the Jesus obeying business. That's our standing order. We start there. I don't think these hypotheticals are necessarily illegitimate questions. I get why someone is concerned about protecting innocent life against evil men. Totally get it. But I think it's these kind of hypotheticals, we should answer them after we have established what Jesus has commanded of us. That's the starting point. And then once we've decided that, then we can figure out how to navigate the hypotheticals. They're sort of used as a way to say, well, forget what Jesus said. What about this? And I think that that's not the right way to approach it. And so I think I'll end here. The fourth assumption I think here that people are making is that someone who does violence to you has defeated you. that this life is really all we have and it must be protected. And that's an atheistic assumption. You know, if you're in Christ, you can't really be killed. Anyone who dies in Christ is secure, far more secure than the murderer outside of Christ who outlives their victims. And so I think those are all things we have to sort of establish first, and then we can start to sort of talk about, okay, well, what about this? What about that? What do you do? And also I think just keeping in mind, there's grace here. I love my family. I don't know necessarily what I would do in a difficult circumstance. I know that a lot of people have managed to navigate these really horrible circumstances where the death squads are at your door and you respond like Christ and avert disaster. It does happen. But I also know that in a difficult time, I might use violence. I might use force. I might take out somebody. And I believe that there is grace. And so I think this is really about, where is our heart? What are we preparing to do? Are we wanting to use violence? Is that something that we're going to set ourselves to do? Or is it something we're going to say, well, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to love my enemies. And, you know, if I fall short, as I do in so many other areas of my life, there is grace. And so I'll probably stop talking now because we've got about 4 or 5 minutes for Jason to give some thoughts.
Oh, I'm glad you went first. Those were some awesome, brilliant insights. And I loved the humility and the grace there. You know, I have seen in my years pacifists act violently, and I have seen soldiers act in ways that would make Gandhi proud. And so that's why I actually don't call myself a peacemaker. I call myself an aspiring peacemaker. I do believe being faithful in the small everyday moments of loving enemies and overcoming evil with good build up the habit that hopefully when those big kind of what if scenarios actually come about, that I will respond in the way that's faithful to Jesus. But like you said, I think we need to dethrone these what if scenarios because Jesus is Lord and we follow his teaching. These what if scenarios, they do have a place, like you said, where they can help us figure out how do we apply the teachings of Jesus in some of the hardest moments of life. But Jesus is Lord, he's on the throne, not these what if scenarios. You know, in college, I grappled with a lot of these, and a lot of these questions were thrown at me as I was trying to figure out my stance on violence. You know, what if someone tries to hurt your wife or kill your children? What about Hitler? You know, if you could have stopped him, what if you could stop a terrorist before he kills innocent people, right? These what if scenarios, they're usually designed in such a way or told or asked in such a way where it makes pacifism appear naive and impractical, right? And I like how you tried to unpack some of the hidden assumptions there, Cody. Maybe I'll piggyback on that and use that language. One of the hidden embedded assumptions in most what if questions or scenarios is pacifism is assumed to be the same as passivism. It's assumed that if you don't use violence, then you're not doing anything. But Jesus, I believe, was a pacifist. But as Gandhi said, he was also the most active resister of injustice in human history. So that's the first thing. When we say don't use violence in addressing these scenarios, it doesn't mean that you do nothing. Second, it's usually assumed that the end result of violence will be successful and nonviolence will be ineffective. But like you brought up that research by Chenoweth and Stevens, there's a book even Why Civil Resistance Works by them that shows that nonviolent direct action is usually as on average twice as effective as violent direct action. And even when it fails at obtaining its goals within 5 years of such actions, there's a much higher chance of a healthy justice and democracy in the region and less loss of life and damage to infrastructure. And it's also presumed there that we know for certain what the end result would be of using violence and of nonviolence, but that's not how it works in real life. You know, it's never considered that even if violence is successful in those what-if scenarios, we fail to think about would it trigger the downward spiral of retaliatory violence that so often happens. And then finally, you touched on this as well, Cody, but I'll use different language. It's assumed that death is the worst outcome, but for Christians, death is not the worst thing that can happen to us. Turning our backs on Jesus is the worst thing that can happen for us. And I'm reminded of a pastor who 15 years ago, I heard tell the story about he was walking the streets of Toronto when he saw a black woman sprint past him. And he thought to himself, she doesn't seem like she's out for a jog. It seems like she's running from something. And a couple seconds later, four skinheads, neo-Nazis, go chasing after her. And immediately he realized she's running for her life. So he turns around and starts running after them. Not as fast as them. So by the time he found them in an alley, they had her on the ground and she was curled up and they were kicking her in the face, kicking her all over. These were not just, I want to hurt you. These were, I could care less if you die kicks. And immediately, not knowing what to do, he pushed his way in between them, stood between the woman and these four men and said, I am a Christian, which means there are two things I cannot do. He said, number one, I cannot sit by and do nothing as I see you beat up someone. And number two, I cannot hurt you. So if you must beat me up instead or walk away. Now, in this situation, they cursed at him for a while and then walked away. But what if they had beat him up and killed him? I imagine his congregation would have said, there was our beloved pastor, faithful to the way of Jesus to the end, right? These what-if scenarios, you know, what about Hitler? There are so many stories, even from that time period. André Trochme, pastoring a small village in France. You can listen to a 10-episode miniseries about him. I think it's called City of Refuge is the podcast. And tells the story of how their village rescued hundreds of Jewish children. Corrie ten Boom, or Bishop Kirill, this Orthodox priest in Bulgaria, when Jews were on the train already, all set to be sent off to an extermination camp. He and his congregation go down and he quotes from the book of Ruth, your God is my God and your people will be my people. And he opens the door and tries to climb in and join them. And the soldiers pull him off, right? And so then undeterred, he and his congregation lay down on the tracks and refused to move. In the end, they saved those Jews from being sent off to extermination camps, and not a single Jew in Bulgaria was shipped off throughout the war. So people want to say, oh, nonviolence can't be effective. But I think there are some beautiful examples. And Jake, you touched, you hit the nail on the head when you used that word of creativity. It just takes some creativity. We spend so much time investing in war and how to be effective in war. The church needs to use its creativity, its prophetic imagination to figure out how to be faithful to the nonviolent love of Jesus in the hard places of our world today.
Well, I'm going to say that's a pretty good way to wrap it up there. Always count on Jason for the stories, for the passion and emotion there. Love it so much. Jason, Cody, thanks so much for being on today. This is a topic I'm passionate about. People that listen to the show can probably tell. This is kind of one of my, pet projects of trying to get people to wrestle with these questions. We've had a lot of great episodes. We had that live stream, that event on Christian response to nonviolence. We've talked about militarism. We've had Joshua and Nat, both former people in the military who have left that and have chosen that the pacifist life, if that's the title you want to give it. So, passion of mine, thanks for you guys being on. I knew you'd be intelligent voices to help us wrestle with these topics, this big topic. Should Christians kill? What is our Christian duty here when it comes to violence? And I think we've done a great job surveying a lot of the things, but go back and listen to their respective episodes, go back and read their books and podcasts and projects and all that kind of thing. We had a lot of good stuff mentioned today that I'll try to throw in the show notes when, not in the live version, but when this comes out as an episode. So Jason, Cody, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cody. Thanks, Jake. You guys inspire me.
Oh, too kind.
Good to talk to you both.
Everybody else, thanks for listening to this episode of Christianity Without Compromise. Really appreciate it. If you would rate and review, share this episode, tell us what you learned. And if you have any hate mail, send it to me, not these guys. They probably get enough of that already. So thanks, everybody. Thank you for listening to Christianity Without Compromise. We just had a great episode, and I encourage you to put into practice the wisdom and advice that you received. please subscribe to the podcast and newsletter at jakedobrins.substack.com. That way, right in your inbox, every Tuesday you'll receive the new episode, and on Fridays you'll receive a newsletter written by me that tells a funny or interesting story with a spiritual point. This episode was recorded by me, Jake Dobrins, in conjunction with Theophany Media, my podcast production company. Please rate and review the show on your favorite podcast player, and don't forget to share your favorite episodes with your friends and your enemies. Thank you so much for all your support, and we look forward to bringing you another great episode next week.